You are listening to the 2015 M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust's Christian Leadership Conference, Understanding the New Millennium, Reexamining the Cultural Narratives. In the final talk, Dave Blanchard talks about harnessing the entrepreneurship narrative.
Thanks to all of you for being here and being such a listening audience. It's truly a pleasure to be here and to be a part of what's been happening the last couple days. I know... If you're like I am, I've certainly learned a lot that I'm going to take back to what we do at Praxis and how we think about some of these narratives. my hope this morning is to certainly talk about this entrepreneurial narrative in society and also kind of tie it into a lot of the talks that we've heard over the course of the last couple days. But I want to start just with a frame of sort of convincing you that there is an entrepreneurial narrative. I know we hear a lot about entrepreneurship. Maybe some of you think it's a buzzword or something that people talk about, but is it real? Are things happening around it? I want to kind of show you what I think we see happening in culture, and then I want to talk about how I think this relates deeply to two things that are important for you in your day-to-day lives as directors of organizations along the lines of talent and strategy. So let me dive in here and talk about what's going on in society. So we would say that there's three large shifts happening in culture right now around entrepreneurship. These are along the lines of interest, influence, and impact. There's a major study by the Kauffman Foundation, an organization that is the primary group that studies entrepreneurship and have done so over the last several decades. They say 54% of millennials want to join a startup or have already started something themselves. We see this as a massive vocational shift, right? If the generation before wanted to be lawyers and doctors, if this generation is even thinking about those fields, they at least want to start their own practices, right? It's a very different mindset and a very different model. Secondly, along the lines of influence, we probably all feel this, whether we've identified it or not, but the influence of entrepreneurs in society is higher than it has ever been. I would make the case. We're probably familiar with Muhammad Yunus winning the Nobel Prize. All of us, or many of us, saw the Kony 2012 video. Whatever you thought of it, the most viral viewed video of all time by Invisible Children, a nonprofit. We've got a show on primetime television that's highly watched called Shark Tank. Maybe you're familiar with the HBO parody show, Silicon Valley. As well. There's actually a parody show about the field of entrepreneurship. I think that's maybe the pinnacle of cultural achievement. And then I love this last example here. You may not recognize these guys. If you're familiar at all with the Foursquare technology app, it's something that allows you to check into a venue. Like I could say I'm here at the Hilton Vancouver. These guys were the designers of that app, which kind of took off in a lot of urban settings. And this is actually an ad campaign that The Gap did. And these guys, Dennis and Naveen, were actually featured alongside movie stars and rock stars. It was movie stars, rock stars, and entrepreneurs. So if that gives you a sense for where entrepreneurs are seen in culture today, it's a big one. That comes with good things and bad things, right? It's in some sense, it's like the moral responsibility of the athlete, which has always been debated, right? Are these people supposed to be our leaders? But they are seen as our leaders, and they're seen as leaders in your communities as well. I'm sure you can see that in different ways. So finally, on the lines of impact, we've got this guy, Jack Dorsey. If you know Jack, he's the founder of Twitter and Square. I think maybe the world's most recent billionaire. And he said something very interesting on the cover of Fortune magazine. He said the most efficient means to spread an idea today is corporate structure. That 200 years ago, it was something different. And that 100 years from now, it will be something completely different. So this is an interesting idea that this moment in time, when you think about the talent that's interested in it and the capital resources that are around it, are creating this ecosystem for entrepreneurship to really thrive, where people say, if I want to spread an idea, I need to start something. So let's look a little bit about how this happens. Let's consider these three ventures, which you could put 100 people up on this list. But first of all, you've got Jeff Skoll. Jeff's one of the founding team of eBay. He's led a number of different initiatives. Maybe you're familiar with the Skoll Foundation, things like that. One of Jeff's initiatives is Participant Media. Now, Jeff actually recently took over as the CEO of Participant, a media group that he started. No doubt all of you have seen or heard of one of their films. whether it's one of the major food movies, whether it was An Inconvenient Truth, Waiting for Superman, all of these things are kind of pervasive in our culture. And as Fortune magazine said, that these films tend to reflect Skoll's progressive and ultimately optimistic worldview. So on a different side of the spectrum, you've got Dov Charney. Dov's the founder of American Apparel. If you're not familiar with them, they are considered the largest manufacturer of clothing in North America. They've been going through some business challenges recently, if you paid attention to that story. But the major thing that American Apparel is known for is, one, their American manufacturing, and then, two, their hyper-sexualized advertisements. This is actually a quote from their website, if you can imagine this. It says, much of American Apparel's success must be attributed to Charney's wild, wacky, hypersexual persona, extending out to the highly targeted advertisements. He doesn't believe in monogamy or marriage and isn't ashamed to acknowledge consensual sexual relationships with employees of his company. That's one idea that he is spreading in culture through entrepreneurship. Last on the list here is Ev Williams. Ev is another one of the founders of Twitter. You'll see them come up a lot. And among a number of things, he started Blogger and now Medium. But he's also started an investment firm called Obvious Ventures. I thought it was very interesting to hear what he said about this investment fund. It's a $120 million fund in Silicon Valley. He said, Obvious is simply the vehicle through which we co-invest in entrepreneurs who share our worldview. As Biz Stone, his, his partner on it, said, Obvious is a philosophy. So we have almost philosophy-driven entrepreneurship, right? You can see why all this comes together to suggest that something we say at Praxis a lot, that the future of culture depends largely on the next generation of entrepreneurs. We really believe this is true. Entrepreneurs can exist in a lot of places, which we'll talk about. But recently, an ecosystem of support has emerged for entrepreneurs. So you might be familiar with some of these names. Obviously, Praxis, the organization I get to lead, is on this list. We're part of this. But these organizations have come alongside entrepreneurs, and they've actually de-risked it. So we might think, wow, entrepreneurship is this high-risk thing. It's so, you know, it takes a lot of audacity to go and start your own thing. Now, don't get me wrong, it is super hard. But organizations like these, both on the for-profit and nonprofit side of the equation, have come in and said, we'll give you mentorship, access to capital, resources, community, to make this feel a lot more comfortable and a lot more possible. It's also interesting how there's a little bit of a sub-narrative that's happened in our larger culture around entrepreneurship that suggested that entrepreneurial endeavors are not abnormal, they're actually normal. That shift is meaningful. I remember after I started my first venture, I went back to my alma mater to talk, and someone raised their hand in the back, and they said, how did you convince your parents not to get a job after college? And to be honest, I'd never really thought about that because my parents were very encouraging in that way. But that was a real thing, right? How could you ever do a startup? It's so risky. That really doesn't exist anymore. Now parents are proud that their kids are going into startups. It's a new opportunity. It's the new thing to do. That's a significant thing because we all respond to our social dynamics, right? We all do things differently based on what the people around us encourage us to do and how they think about what we do. So, in fact, I would argue that while it used to be a risky career move in general to go to a startup where you either succeeded or failed, the now organizations, maybe yours in fact, actually want to hire entrepreneurs, whether they've succeeded or failed. So it's actually a good career move to try something and wherever it works out. Now, this is actually an exciting moment in time, I think. Obviously, through our work at Praxis, we get to support a lot of these entrepreneurs. In fact, we've worked with over 100 of them over the last 4.5 years across a whole variety of sectors. These are Christian leaders who are working in for-profit and nonprofit space. We have folks across the spectrum from education and housing and economic development to fashion, like Cole Cresilius, who you may have met here over the weekend, to things as traditional as orphan care and as out there as virtual reality in Hollywood. And bring this up because I want to make the case to you that entrepreneurs are one of the sort of biggest distributors of cultural impact in our time today, no matter what context they're in. So This is a chart that I think explains how entrepreneurs go out into the world and start to shape the culture in general. You see, the entrepreneur starts with a core idea that they believe in, and it starts to shape the organization around them. It shapes the employees that they hire, They build this organizational culture that stands for something, believes in something, and goes after something. And then they start to shape the stakeholders around it, right? They start to shape certainly the customers or the beneficiaries that they work with. They also shape the vendors in the supply chain. They shape the people that they talk to about this. They shape the media around them. And then as those stakeholders go, they start to shape the best practices of industries, both collectively and individually. If they grow large enough, they can actually recast an imagination for an industry. And I would argue that as these industries go, so goes the broader culture, right? So a perfect example of this is a guy you probably are familiar with, probably the greatest nonprofit growth story of the last decade, Scott Harrison, the founder and CEO of Charity Water. So I just wanted to call out a few things here, picked up from different places. And part of the interesting story behind Charity Water, if you're not familiar with it, is actually that Scott's heart was not originally for water. He found his way to that as the cause that would shape our society the most. But he actually wanted to reshape charity. He wanted to change how charity was thought about in our society. Listen to what he says here. He has this gospel-minded, worldview-driven idea. He says, I wanted to reinvent charity, he says. I thought it had become broken and stigmatized. The word means love, and I truly believe that giving time, talent, and money is wholly redemptive. It's an interesting angle. He's gone on to start to shape industry and culture. We certainly feel this at Praxis. A number of organizations that apply to us every year say, we're kind of working out the charity water model. We're doing that. We're thinking about it this way. Jack Dorsey, who we mentioned before, who's actually a mentor of Scott's, said that Scott is disrupting charity by rethinking the foundation of it. Charity Water is not just innovating to track its effect around the world, but how charities should be run. In Wired, Harrison said, we're restoring faith to donors. We're inspiring giving and inspiring compassion, and that is our why. It's interesting. Finally, he makes the case that entrepreneurship is an incredible platform for the gospel. He gives his testimony in every place he goes. And most of those places are places that Christians aren't often found. Quoted here in Fast Company, he says, after a decade of serving myself, I re-embraced my Christian faith and decided to serve God and the poor. And he truly has done this in a lot of ways. I urge you to look at this next picture. This is actually taken from the New York Times. If you can't see it too well, Scott's down there in the front right of the picture sitting down. This is actually a group of entrepreneurs that he took to Africa to see their work. He said his only lament was that they had to take a private jet to get around because he wanted them to really experience what it was like. In fact, a New York Times journalist went on this trip with him. I think there's a couple things that are very interesting to call out that highlight this entrepreneurial generation. You'll notice here, these are the people who back Charity Water. Entrepreneurs aren't only shaping society through their ventures, they're also the future of philanthropy. As highlighted by Peter last night and Mark Zuckerberg's enormous 99% gift of his $45 billion. These are the people who are shaping the future of society, they're shaping the future of what gets given to, and they think in a certain way, and it's critical for us to understand that narrative to work with them. They have a different expectation of pace and efficiency and scale and things like that. That's not to be feared, it's to be embraced, and frankly, we have a lot we can learn from them. But all this comes together to really put the pieces together on something I'd like to suggest, that at this moment in history, that entrepreneurs are actually these incredibly winsome cultural witnesses, and that their ventures actually have this opportunity to be this demonstrated apologetic. When people say, I don't really want to hear about your faith, I know you believe this, but I don't see it in your life, entrepreneurs can actually say, this is the work of my hands. Here I am, and here's how my venture explains what I think about the world and how I do that. So that's kind of a brief snapshot of what I would say is the entrepreneurial generation. I would just, again, just to emphasize it, I think we are in a time in history unlike any other for entrepreneurship where society is going towards starting things. And the vocations of this next generation is very, very focused on this. So the big question is, how can we harness this narrative, right? What does it mean? Well, again, I want to make it as practical as possible for you in your context. And a mentor of mine says that the job of the CEO or the executive director is fairly simple. He says, set strategy, get human capital, and get financial capital, right? Those are the three things that a great CEO does. And sometimes we feel like if we get the financial capital, then we can hire the people and we can set the strategy. And it's very focused on the financial capital. But I would actually argue it's inverted. I think strategy and human capital are closely knit together. Obviously, as we get great people, we can set bigger strategy, and great people set better strategy. And great strategy and great story, to Jason's point, actually recruits better people to the team. So once we figure those two things out, I think financial capital follows great people and great vision. And so I want to take the rest of the time here in the talk to talk about how I think we can harness this entrepreneurial narrative in the talent space and in the strategy space for each one of you. So let's first look at the talent side. Let's start understanding how today's entrepreneurial talent thinks. Back to this whole idea of empathy, we need to understand entrepreneurs before we would suppose to engage them and work with them, right? I want to talk about how they think about the world, how they think about nonprofits like you, how they think about institutions, and then ultimately how they think about themselves in these larger cultural narratives. So first thing to think about is what the New York Times said. I think they summed it up very greatly in this article called Generation Cell. They said that today's ideal social form is not the commune or the movement or the individual creator as such. It's actually the small business. Think about that. Every artistic or moral aspiration, music, food, good works, what have you, is expressed in those terms. So I want to make the point that a lot of entrepreneurs are thinking in an enterprise mindset. Let me give you a few quick examples from our world at Praxis. This is Ben and Laura Harrison, the founders of a company called Jonas Paul. Ben and Laura had a son who was born. Jonas Paul is his name. He was born blind, which was, as you can imagine, a very painful experience for them. They decided they wanted to creatively respond to this, and they didn't start a nonprofit. They actually decided to start a business called Jonas Paul Eyewear. They had this understanding that there is something deeply broken in society about how kids get made fun of at school for needing glasses, especially thick glasses. And they said, we don't want our son to go through that. We want to be part of that. We actually want to change that stigma in larger culture. So Jonas Paul Eyewear is a fashion eyewear brand for kids. So they can, in second grade, need eyewear, and instead of going to school and being called Four Eyes, they can actually have fashionable glasses like we would want when we're 18 or 19 or 20 or even whatever age we are today. An interesting creative response through small business. The next example is another Praxis fellow of ours, Jessica Ray. Jessica grew up in LA. She was an actor. Actually was one of the Power Rangers, if you can believe that, the purple one. And Jessica was, as she says, hanging out at the pool one day and received a bit of critique on the size of her swimsuit from one of her male Christian friends. And they had a kind of long discussion about this. And she started thinking about what the fashion culture was saying about women and their bodies and that sort of thing, and decided that she wanted to stop wearing bikinis, basically. She couldn't find anything that was fashionable to wear, so she decided to make her own. This ultimately turned into a business called Ray Swimwear. They're set to do about $1 million in swimsuits this year, with the idea that they could create fashion-forward swimsuits that are one pieces based off of the sort of fashion of Audrey Hepburn, so very classic, timeless, gorgeous designs. The idea that perhaps she could recast an imagination for younger women around how they think about sexuality and fashion and this sort of the hypersexualized culture that we live in. Really kind of an amazing idea and an intriguing way to address that, right? Through enterprise. And just in case you were wondering, is everything up for grabs? Want to talk about Hans Hess from Elevation Burgers. Yes, burgers even can be redeemed. So Hans is one of our mentors at Praxis. Hans is a perfect example of someone who sees how to take an idea into culture through entrepreneurship. He was working on Capitol Hill and received a report that came across his desk. And this report said that 8,000 people were going to die from not being responsive to antibiotics. They would get sick, they'd take the antibiotic, and it just wouldn't work. And the reason it wouldn't work is because about 80% of the antibiotics industry is actually focused on livestock, which is kind of this mind-boggling thing. So the beef are getting pumped with antibiotics. You eat enough beef, you become unresponsive to to this antibiotics. He looked at the stats and said this 8,000 was going to grow to 25,000, was actually going to grow to 200,000 by 2025. And he thought he should do something about it. He thought, this is tragic. The burger is sort of this classic American food that he loved. And so he wanted to reinvent it. So he started Elevation Burger. Elevation was grass-fed, organic burgers, no antibiotics. He came up with his own recipes for olive oil baked fries or olive oil made fries, and started with one shop in Falls Church, Virginia. Elevation is now 35 different stores around the world, and Panera Bread, obviously a huge chain, recently decided to stop having antibiotics in their chicken. And in an article in USA Today, gave Hans himself a head nod for starting this conversation of how fast food could help shift the conversation around antibiotics. Interesting model for cultural change, right? So so that's one way to think about how are they thinking, how are entrepreneurs thinking about the world in general? They're thinking through enterprise. How can we address problems with this sort of profit purpose alignment? Secondly, and this is kind of a related point, and a little bit of a painful one to talk about, but nevertheless, I think amongst millennials, most nonprofits have a bit of a brand problem. And I can say this as a nonprofit leader myself, who's wrestled with these sorts of things in talent conversations. And the thing about brands is, you know, there can be story problems, and they can be donor challenges, and they can be all those things. But at the end of the day, I think brand problems are talent problems. Because they're how the world thinks about you and whether they think they want to join you in their mission, right? I probably don't need to tell you this, but there's a lot of folks out there who think that nonprofits are too slow, they're inefficient, they're not scalable. And I think, frankly, this next generation has a little bit of a postmodern feel to it in the sense of them being anti-institutional, right? They don't think that that they should really have to engage and deal with institutions. And it was just kind of an ironic thing, right? If you think about it, they're actually, as they set out to be entrepreneurs, trying to create the next institutions. But nonetheless, this is how they think about it. Instead, startups are the cool opportunities and social enterprises are the hot things. And the nonprofits and the older businesses have a difficult time attracting talent. It's even portrayed this way in the media. Listen to this sort of incisive and pessimistic quote from The Atlantic about institutions and large organizations. It says, while many large organizations might similarly benefit from having a kid in the room, someone who's energetic, passionate, emotional, excitable, it's hard to envision a corporate phenotype that would be more doomed. The environment just doesn't support it. Sure, companies trot out bromides about cultivating entrepreneurship while HR departments sponsor group training sessions on innovative thinking. But the reality is that the culture of most big companies is geared towards performing established activities in increasingly efficient ways. Simply stated, doing the old things better takes precedence over doing new things well enough. Most employees, and certainly the ones who last, figure out extremely quickly how you're supposed to act at work. You could say that most large organizations have elected to trade the passion of young love for the predictability of adult relationships. Wow. Okay, so maybe this is true in certain cases, right? But are we actually as doomed as The Atlantic wants us to believe? I don't think so. I think there's ways to think differently, ways to create different environments that engage these entrepreneurs. And this is where I want to revisit Alyssa's core narratives from her opening talk. And really start to understand how this fits into how these millennials think about, these entrepreneurs think about themselves. So first of all, let's just recap these authenticity, genius, and power, right? I think these are so core to how entrepreneurs think about what they're about to do. These narratives are part of why they are attracted to this space, right? They want to do something that is true to themselves. They see Steve Jobs as the sort of idolized version of what they might all become. And they see the power that comes through a startup. They have control over it. They can direct it. And ultimately, if it's successful and they are a genius like they all imagine, then they might actually have incredible power. So I think we need to understand these things, and we need to embrace that they're real. We can't deny them or reject them, but I do think we can participate in redeeming them, and I think your institutions are uniquely set up to have that conversation, because really what we need to do is we need to understand that these are the cultural narratives that younger folks are coming in with, And then we need to help them think about how to mature in their development of those things without rejecting them outright. So I want to go through each of them individually quickly here. First, I want to talk about authenticity. So, you know, I think authenticity could be tied pretty deeply to this idea of calling, right? And something that we talk about a lot in Christian culture, calling and vocation and important things. But the reality is that for most 20-somethings, you don't know what your calling is, right? You're trying to figure out what your skill set is, what you're good at. But I think that there's a key difference here in how we do this. And I think we actually can offer a lens of purpose. And I think purpose is actually for the 20-something closely enough aligned with the idea of calling that you can start to provide a trajectory towards calling through providing purpose at the very beginning. Let me give you a quick framework as an example of this. So this is a guy, Bud Cadell. He wrote this up, but I really love this. He says, this is how to get to a good career. He says, figure out what you do well, figure out what you love to do, and figure out what you can be paid to do, and try to live in the middle of that. Really, really great model, really simple, right? I think historically, a lot of folks said, you know, what is it that I can do well, and what is it that I can get paid to do? And I'm going to figure that out. I'm going to keep doing that. And I'll kind of learn to love it, and maybe I'll do some meaningful work on the side. This is particularly true for folks who come into the market with no experience, no opportunities. They're like, hey, can I get a job, actually? And, you know, we should be thinking about that. They should be thinking about this. But what's unique about this generation of entrepreneurs is I think they are very, very resolved and determined to enter through the lens of what they love to do. They think they have a right to that from day one. And maybe they should. Maybe they should go after that as hard as they are. Certainly they need to pick up skill sets. But I think this just underscores the idea that these entrepreneurs, these would-be entrepreneurs, part of the reason they do this is because they want to enter through the lens of what they love to do. They want to pursue that first. And I think the way that we can respond is by giving them an environment of purpose. Secondly, I want to talk about the idea of genius, right? Because I think again, for this generation, genius is tied to this question that Alyssa raised of, can I be good and great at the same time? People have big, big dreams. We see our entrepreneurs wrestle with this all the time at Praxis. And I think our hope here is not to push back and say, you know what, you need to get in line and earn your keep and spend your time here at our institution before you have the opportunity to do anything, but actually embrace that ambition, embrace those dreams, but also do a little bit of what James K. Smith refers to as redemption. We need to help reorient and redirect the culture-making capacities of this generation. So shift this dream of genius to one of holy ambition. Allow them to still dream on a very, very big canvas, but have it be the canvas of the kingdom of God instead of their own personal canvas. I think this is actually a way to serve this generation in an amazing way. Finally, I want to talk about this idea of power in these entrepreneurs, how they think about this. And certainly, power is something that we all have a desire for in some way because we want to have some autonomy. Dan Pink talks about autonomy and mastery and purpose being at the core of any fulfilling vocation. But I think we can kind of have a different view on power that's cynical and negative sometimes. And sometimes, you know, sometimes these millennials they do want power all the time, but I would say that, again, this is the redeemed version of power is actually an understanding that most of them are seeking after responsibility. They want to know that what they're doing matters and that they are trusted with it and that they can go forward. They don't want to be told to wait their turn. See, the startups allow them to take their turn right now. It allows them to go after what they want to. So as a friend of ours says, Steve Garber, says there's nothing more primordial than the responsibility of knowledge. And it is our glory and our shame. As Václav Havel says, argued so forcefully, our responsibility is at the heart of our humanity. So how can we recast this idea of power in the frame of responsibility and allowing people to be responsible? So just as a recap here, I think that if you can create environments and projects in your organizations that allow younger talent who has a lot of drive to have purpose in what they do, to have a large canvas for a holy ambition, and ultimately a responsibility over the things that they're working on. I do think you can attract this entrepreneurial talent, you can keep them, and they can create incredible value inside your organization. So secondly, I want to talk about strategy. I want to talk about how entrepreneurship culture actually challenges us to create narratives, which is a different thing. You're going to see a lot of parallels in what I'm about to say with Jason's talk. And I think this is a good thing because it's a way to link the story of your organization, how you talk about what you do, with the dreams of your organization, what you're about to do, and really the operations. I think any organization has to link their story and their operations in a powerful way to accomplish the goals of it, right? So I love what one of our fellows says. He says that entrepreneurs see a better future and proceed to create it. Okay, so I think we can learn from this entrepreneurial sector in this way, in scale and in scope and in future thinking. I think there is one reality that I would say about a lot of our organizations is that generally speaking, as nonprofits, we sort of examine the world, right? And then we respond to the practical needs that we see in front of us. And this is really, really worthy work. This is important and critical, obviously. And we kind of adapt to what's happening around us. Hopefully we're hearing the cultural narratives from today, from these times together, and we're saying, oh, well, what do we do with that current situation? But I'd actually argue from an entrepreneurial sense that this actually leads to a crisis of imagination at the very conceptual level of our work. Because ultimately we are responding to today, and I would argue that culture today is actually a product of someone's vision 10 or more years ago. It's a long time ago that the things were set in motion to have the conversations that we've been having today. So as we think about creating that future, what exactly does that mean? I'll give you one example of this. So Whole Foods, right? We're all familiar with this. There's one 15 minutes down the street here in Vancouver. There's probably one in your neighborhood, wherever you are. Whether you shop there or not, it sort of feels like Whole Foods is this you know, somewhat overnight success. In the last 5-10 years or whatever, it's all of a sudden, it is everywhere, right? And the people who started Whole Foods, John Mackey is the founder, had this vision to shape how we eat. They shape our health. And if anyone knows who shops there, they've actually kind of reshaped our budgets too, right? It can be painful at times. here's the interesting backstory here is on the left, if you look at this, this is actually the first Whole Foods. It was called Safer Way, which was a dig at Safeway, right? Safeway is where John Mackey's mom shopped. It was more and more processed foods. She saw that as a revolution, a freedom from some of the homemaking demands. But as he realized it, he saw that it has had a lot of damage on how people ate, how their bodies responded to food, and looked into the future and said he wanted to create a different way, a different sort of imagination of eating. I think we could all agree that Whole Foods has driven a different way of thinking about food, whether it's organics or otherwise, into our culture today. But here's the thing, that was 1978. That wasn't 5 or 10 years ago even, right? That was 1978, 37 years ago, this person saw something that was happening in culture and saw a better future and proceeded to create it through a long obedience in the same direction. So I wanna encourage us to think about this, and I wanna again press in on the idea that this is actually the way that the entrepreneurial culture works. If we're harnessing the entrepreneurial narrative, we are always thinking into the future. We have to be minded towards today, obviously, but we're always thinking into the future. Another example of this is Fred Wilson. Fred, if you don't know him, he is the founder of Union Square Ventures, which is arguably the most successful investing firm, angel investing firm, which means small dollar amounts of our time. He's the first investor in Twitter, in Foursquare, what I mentioned earlier, in Etsy. He's created billions of dollars in economic value for him and his shareholders. He says something interesting here that I think is very relevant for everything that we do on a daily basis, how he thinks about investments. He says, thesis-driven investing involves drawing a picture of where your particular area of focus is going. He says, I like to take a 5-to-10-year view, and once you have mapped out that picture, it becomes your thesis, and you evaluate every investment decision that you make in the context of that thesis. I think that's something that, again, that we can do. We can take a thesis-driven approach to our organizations. This is closely tied to strategy, but it's a little different in the sense that it's actually looking at what's going on in the culture, what's going on in the world, and how do we start to shape it. Now, obviously, Fred, as an investor, has incredible impact in shaping what gets funded and what comes to pass. Each of our institutions has that institutional power in its own way, in our own context, in our own places. Another organization that's done this tremendously well in a unique way that I would actually encourage you to try as an organizational experiment is a group called Y Combinator. If you're not familiar with them, they are by far and away the most successful kind of startup accelerator incubator program that exists. They're in Silicon Valley. They're sort of considered the Harvard of these types of things. 1% of entrepreneurs that apply get into it. They've created multiple billion-dollar companies. And I would argue, actually, if you get into Y Combinator now, it's actually a bigger credential than Stanford MBA. So the big question here, the big thing that they've done is actually published a list of ideas that they say are startup ideas we'd like to fund. They've said, they've looked at the world and they've said, here's the things that we'd like to accomplish and how do we get them done? So just an idea for you to go out and publish this. I think we could aim to do this. We could imagine the kingdom and proceed to create it. And we could create new initiatives that redeem these negative cultural narratives, intentionally create new ones. As Karl Barth said, the church exists to set up in the world a new sign, which is radically dissimilar to the world's own manner and which contradicts it in a way that is full of promise. So if we have a default technique for producing ideas, which is entrepreneurship, and creating kind of market-ready opportunities, I think we have a unique lens on that, where we can start with theology, as Jason said. We can move on to culture, and we can start to understand what's on God's heart, what's going on in this moment in time. It's hard to do this. As Steve Garber says, it's so easy to deceive ourselves about our place and purpose in time, so we have to think about it deeply. Everyday Theology, a book I would highly recommend if you're interested in this, talks about how we need to get a multi-perspectival approach to do these things, to illumine what's going on in the cultural discourse. It's part of what we're doing here. We're understanding history and economics and sociology and marketing and, of course, theology to understand how we can plan out these theses. And here's the thing. A lot of times we think of theology and culture as these constraining factors. Oh, we can't do this or we can't do that. I would encourage you to see them as a highly generative construct that allows you to go out into the world and make new things with a unique view. As Peter Thiel says, the best entrepreneurs know that every great venture is built on a secret that's hidden from the outside. And I think this is highly related to 1 Corinthians 2, right? If you're familiar with this, the Bible says that we declare God's wisdom, a mystery that has been hidden, and that God destined for our glory before time began. I won't read all of this, but I'd encourage you to think about how this is connected to what we can see and how we see the world in a unique lens through the gospel. We can design for true cultural narratives at the intersection of these things. So real quickly, a closing story that I hope is inspirational and practical. An organization called One Hope in Florida, maybe you're familiar with them, they're focused on helping bring God's world to every child. Their president's daughter at Azusa Pacific was graduating in 2010 and knew a crew of undergrads, about five students, and recruited them in and gave them a lot of autonomy and intentional time and money and capital from the institution. A lot of different ventures came out of this. Their global internship program called Cultivate, something called God Truth Project that they ultimately shelved. And then a last one here called Kindred. This is one of our Praxis fellows, Leighton Cusack, second from left. He started out with a theology that said that God cares about generosity deeply. Secondly, he did a cultural analysis and understood that the offering plate was out of date and wanted to create a response to that. The result was that $100 million in generosity was unlocked for the church just through allowing this entrepreneurial talent to be inside of their institution and giving them access to time, as a talent, and to resources. This is a pretty cool story. So I want to end with two questions for you, and hopefully with the idea that you might do something here like that. First, what's your thesis on the narratives of where your sector are going? And where do you ultimately want it to go? You have to answer that question as part of your mission and vision. Secondly, how might your nonprofit be an incubator for kingdom-minded initiatives and entrepreneurs that can help bring that future to pass? I hope you'll create space in your organization for these entrepreneurs so they can unlock incredible value for you, but also, and more importantly, for the kingdom of God. Thanks a lot.